You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are very welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the sound and beyond, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, I'm so excited to have Tim McNulty here in the studio. He's got a fabulous new book to talk to us about today, and it's called Salmon, Cedar, Rock, Rain, Washington's Olympic Peninsula. Now, you know Tim as a poet and an essayist and, you know, a nature writer, but this is almost like a different kettle of fish. So welcome, Tim, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
So can you tell us a little bit about this book? Describe it to our listener.
Well, the book is a project. It's from Braided River, which is the conservation imprint of the Mountaineers Books. The Mountaineers Books, and particularly Braided River, publish books focused toward conservation campaigns, education, activism, engagement is one of their goals for their publication program. And so this is a book that involved a lot of people, myself and nine other writers. They're 10 co-authors of the book. Over 30 photographers. It's a beautiful large format book with a couple of hundred photographs, several essays, a number of sidebars, and really at its heart, it's a celebration of the Olympic Peninsula, both the natural history, the nature, the beauty, the wildness of the peninsula, Olympic National Park, but also inclusive of the traditional native cultures, indigenous cultures of the Olympic Peninsula. There are seven tribal writers representing five tribes on the Olympic Peninsula, each writing about something that's important or significant about their culture, their place, their engagement with place, their conservation history. And so it was really, in many, many ways, a very collaborative project, with the publisher, the staff at Braided Rivers, really being part of the collaboration as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was honored and thrilled to be part of the project. And I had done a couple of previous books with the Mountaineers, and so I knew them, and they knew me, and it was just a treat to be engaged.
Okay, this is an incredible collaborative effort, and I'd like to read some of the names of the tribal members that made their contributions.
Great.
Wendy Sampson, Lonnie Grinnell Greninger, Gary Morishima, Marie Parker Pescua, Francine Swift, Jamie R. Valadez, and then Linda Mapes, who a lot of people are familiar with. So congratulations.
Yes.
On pulling all that together, and also Braided River for this incredible project, because it's really different than other books about the Olympic Peninsula.
Yeah, it is. I've written two or three now about the peninsula, and my focus has traditionally been the park, the wild areas, the national forest wilderness areas, the public lands. This is one that really embraces the communities of the peninsula, with also an emphasis on the larger ecosystem, which of course includes the rivers, the seacoasts, the estuaries, the lowland forests. And so it's a bit of a departure. It was pretty ambitious trying to get that whole story together.
How long did it take?
Well, it took a while. I signed a contract for the book prior to COVID and got working on the essay. In fact, COVID hit and I was very happy to have a project to work on, but it slowed down things on the publisher's end considerably. Everybody was working from home, and you could imagine the collaborative meetings, mm-hmm. and so forth, that publishers, art designers, editors, photo editors, production people, you know, having to work from home, it just slowed things down considerably.
Well, when I say there's a gorgeous photo on every page, I'm not kidding. It's just a beautiful book. And I had it out during the holidays and everybody looked at it and commented on it.
Good. Thank you.
So how about giving us a little bit of a reading from your essay, which is kind of the key introduction.
Yeah, this is first section of my essay. My essay was in 8 parts, and this one goes back to my first encounter with the Olympic Peninsula as a young guy taking the ferry over from Seattle. Two ebony cormorants shot like winged darts across the bow, and gulls glided lazily over the upper deck as the ferry hayak thrummed across the luminescent waters of Puget Sound. The Seattle skyline grew small behind me, its glass towers lit by the setting sun. Before me, the rough-hewn crags of the Olympic Mountains rose blue and snow-capped in the flushed glow of the sky. This was my first long-awaited look at the Olympic Peninsula, the culmination of a summer cross-country hitchhiking trip. Although it was more than 50 years ago, the image remains imprinted in my imagination. In the years since, this wild, wooded, river-carved corner of the Pacific Northwest has become a home for me and a focus of my work as a writer and conservationist. Of course, I knew nothing of that back then. What I remember most vividly is the flush of excitement that accompanied that first glimpse of the mountains. It prickled my skin and kept me out on the windy deck long after my fellow passengers retreated to the warmth of the cabin. And then I go into a little bit of, sort of the natural history, the setting of the sound. And why don't I read just a couple paragraphs of that. From Puget Sound, the Olympic Mountains rise abruptly from saltwater shores and forested foothills, as if adrift in a shallow sea. In many ways, the ocean defines the Olympic Peninsula. Its restless floor gave birth to the mountains and coastal plains, and the perpetual river of moist marine air sustains its stunning profusion of life. Surrounded by water, the Pacific to the west, the enfolding arms of the Salish Sea north and east, and with a low coastal river to the south, the peninsula is nearly an island. For extended periods in its geological past, it was an island, and that legacy is reflected in the character and diversity of plant and animal communities that thrive here today. The peninsula's dense cluster of snow-capped peaks, with their wet-side, dry-side ecologies, and its radiating network of watersheds heading in mountain glaciers and snowfields, and streaming to inlets, bays, and rocky beaches, comprise a land self-contained and apart from the nearby mainland. Geographically, culturally, and historically, the peninsula is a territory unto itself.
It is, and we're so fortunate to be here. I'm sure as you were reading, many of our listeners were thinking about their first ferry ride over
coming across
the Hood Canal Bridge and going, this is where I'm going to live, and being so thrilled. I know I
That's
was.
That's wonderful. I've heard some stories as I've been prompted by that.
Well, I also think it's just incredible, the story about, you know, in the 1800s, the push and pull of exploitation and conservation, and how our place got selected to be, you know, a national park or, you know, a monument. How did that come to be?
Well, that is a long and involved and pretty exciting story. One of the things I stumbled on researching the history section for the book was when the international treaty was drawn, I think it was 1846, the boundary between the U.S. and Canada. That's incredibly late in our history to have a land, you know, just totally
indigenous.
Yes, yes. And so there's so much of the Olympic Peninsula remained intact as history happened on the West Coast. By that time, and we're talking now by the late 1800s, the eastern seaboard forests had long since been logged, the Appalachian forests logged, the great northern pine forests around the Great Lakes had been logged, and I mean nothing left. And people were looking to the West Coast as maybe there's some places where natural native forests can be protected and preserved. And the Olympic Peninsula was one of the areas that was really became a focus of international conservation, national and international conservation efforts.
So how did the Roosevelts get involved in this? What role did Teddy Roosevelt play?
Yeah, Teddy was one of the first old of the big burly hunter, you know, kind of conservation guys. He was establishing wildlife refuges, national wildlife refuges around the country. He established some of the early refuges off the coast of the Olympic Peninsula, and was being prevailed upon by hunting interests that, hey, the Roosevelt elk, or at that time the Olympic elk, were being wiped out on the peninsula. And so he established a little preserve in the heart of the Olympic Mountains in an effort to try to provide habitat to save the elk that now bear his name, mm-hmm. The Roosevelt elk. Yeah.
And so that was in 1909. And then in 1937, FDR stepped in.
Yeah. Well, the small preserve, hopefully to save the elk, wasn't very effective. It didn't include the lower elevation valleys where the great forests were, where the elk winter, and where the great salmon populations are, and where so much of the real, what we value is the biodiversity, the temperate rainforest, the lowland old-growth forests of the Olympic Peninsula. And so a campaign was mounted in the 20s and into the 30s, where some national organizations, the Mountaineers certainly in Seattle, but the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, and some real activists formed a small organization called the Emergency Conservation Association. And they really started pushing very hard to try to get a national park established on the Olympic Peninsula. The timing was good. FDR was a progressive, as everybody knows, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And so in 1937, he was prevailed upon to come to the Olympic Peninsula and see what was here and see what was at stake. He arrived on a Navy destroyer in Port Angeles.
Oh, dear.
There was a huge rally in Port Angeles. It still blows my mind to think about it. 10,000 people showed up, including 3,000 school kids. They had a big banner, "Mr. President, please give us our national park." This had become a cause celeb. The battle was really not whether a park was going to be created at that time. It was how much of the lowland forests were going to be included. And so everybody was for a park, but there were two distinct interests that wanted different shapes to the park.
Well, thank you so much for indulging my love of history.
No.
But our readers also, we better go over to the natural history part pretty quick here. So I'm very curious about the silence and the one square inch of silence that Linda Mapes writes about. And that book and that research was done during the time that I've moved here. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about how our forest became known as one of the quietest places in America?
Yeah, that was almost entirely due to a sound engineer and sound recordist, Gordon Hempton, internationally famous, who traveled all around the world recording natural sounds, waterfalls and forest sounds, birds and wind in the trees and rivers and streams. And he really valued no sounds at all, or just limited natural sounds. And in his recording, with very sophisticated equipment out on the Hoh River, he began to realize this is one of the quietest natural environments of anywhere in the world. I think because of its isolation, because so much of the valley is protected by a national park. So he found a place in the heart of the Hoh rainforest that he decided, I'm just going to make my stand here. This is one square inch of silence, and this has got to be preserved above everything. He wrote a book, One Square Inch of Silence, which became pretty popular and kind of established that whole idea that we're not just protecting natural systems in our national parks, but we're also protecting natural sounds. And so silence is not the silence that you'd hear in this studio when everything's turned off, but it's the silence where natural sounds have prominence. And it's a cool little place on the Hoh. You know, you can kind of look it up on the web and hike out there and
is
get off the trail.
Is it a far hike? Do you go along the Hoh River?
A few miles, between 3 and 4 miles, I think, out there. And it's wonderful. I've been there several times. And, you know, it's kind of like a lot of the other places in the Hoh or on the Queets or on the Quinault. But it's a place that Gordon decided to kind of turn into a real kind of a campaign for respecting natural sounds. And then, of course, that branched off into trying to get a handle on the jets, and particularly the Navy jets flying over.
Yes. Yeah. I was going to say, what about those jets?
I know. What about those guys? Ongoing effort.
Let's turn to the old growth forests. And, you know, that's really where your heart is, and a lot of your life has been spent, or, you know, some incredible moments of your life have been spent on our peninsula and among these trees. So how are we doing? You know, when you drive out there, there's still a lot of scarring. Mm-hmm. You know, people that are first going out to the Hoh to see the rainforest are tourists, and they go, how come there's still how come there's still all these landscape of scarred hillsides?
I know. The thought is some of those people have traveled across the country to visit these incredible forests, but to get there, they're going through what are euphemistically called the working forest or the industrial forests. Mm. Some of that goes back to the early years of conservation on the peninsula, where the Olympic Forest Preserve, 1897, covered almost the entire of the west end of the peninsula. A couple of Republican administrations reduced that by 750,000 acres. And so those lands all were turned over to the state. They were fraudulently homesteaded and became property of timber companies, which they remain today. And so the timber companies, as probably most of your listeners know, they're clear-cutting their forests on an average rotation of about 40 years or less in some instances. And so there is a lot of that. And I think what it does is it puts a lot more emphasis on the protected lands, the national park lands, but also the national forest lands, and importantly, the state of Washington Department of Natural Resource lands, to be managed more sustainably in a way that would involve longer rotations instead of 30, 40 years, maybe 60 or 80 years, in which the forest could then provide habitat for a wider range of species, could protect fishery streams. And that's kind of one of the conservation items that we're hoping this book could help make a little bit of a
difference.
That's
right. I was just going to say, this would be a good moment to bring up one of the reasons that this book has been made by the Braided River imprint is to encourage more conservation, more discussion, and more interest in, because some of us tend to think, well, okay, we're safe here. It's been taken care of, but really it's still a work in progress. And so the listener can learn more at salmoncedar.org. And and also in the book itself, there's a list of resources and discussion groups can build and more activism can always be used.
There's some resource pages in the back that list some of the organizations working on various different aspects of conservation on the peninsula. The organization that I work with, Olympic Park Advocates, was one of the sponsors of the book. And we're all hoping that this book becomes very useful for the land trusts, for the salmon restoration organizations, for the various conservation groups, that it could speak across all the varied interests with this central idea that this is such an incredible place. People have been here for 13,000 years. Let's not blow it in the last century. Okay?
Right. Yeah. Let's not blow it. So we're missing a key predator here, which this book brings up. We know we have cougars and coyotes, but we don't have a wolf. We don't have a pack of wolves. Is there talk about bringing the wolf back to the Olympic Peninsula?
Sure. There has been a lot of discussion about this. And the state of Washington has a wolf recovery plan. Wolves have made their way back to Washington from Idaho, Montana, British Columbia.
They're in the North Cascades.
They're starting to be in the North Cascades, certainly in the northeastern portion of the state. They've migrated down a little bit as far as Oregon and so forth. But the fact of wolves making it on their own back to the Olympic Peninsula after being extirpated from here in the 1920s is very slim, given hesitancy to cross interstate highways. I mean, not just to cross them, but even to get near them. Wolves do not like them, and there's research for that all over the place. So trying to get wolves even across the I-90 into the Southern Cascades has been a challenge. To get enough wolves into the Southern Cascades so that they will naturally migrate across I-5 and then across Highway 12 and
I'm
then
not
make
seeing
it up
it.
Here, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. The state tells us it will, that their recovery plan is sound. There's some scientists over at the University of Washington who are echoing that. But everyone involved with the issue, wolf advocates, they know the wolves aren't going to come back here unless they get put back here like they did in Yellowstone and central Idaho. That's an issue that we bring up with every new park superintendent who comes.
Okay. You're listening to KBDZ, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. I'm talking to Tim McNulty about this wonderful new book, Salmon, Cedar, Rock, and Rain. Let's talk about the sea otter restoration, because that's a beautiful story, too.
Yeah, it is. It's a good model of how an extirpated species can be reintroduced and can thrive and do very well here and reshape the ecosystem. Sea otters were wiped out back in the early 1900s. They were hunted for their furs, incredibly rich fur. and there were no sea otters on the coast. Back in the 60s, I think there was some nuclear testing planned for up in Alaska on the Aleutian Islands, and they decided, let's move some sea otters out of here. And some far-thinking Fish and Wildlife Service biologists said, well, the Olympic Peninsula, Washington State used to have some. Let's put some down there. And they did. They did it in 69 and also off of Oregon and in 70. The 69 reintroduction didn't work very well because they just dropped them off. And, you know, sea otters really needed to clean their fur and get acclimated. So
Our bull kelp?
Yeah. So the next year, they gave them a chance to get acclimated and, you know, to clean themselves and from being in cages and flown down. And they did well. That was 1970. Today, there's over 1,000 sea otters on the coast. They've absolutely reshaped the coastal landscape by feeding on one of their primary sources of sea urchins. They've allowed the kelp forests to come back. Kelp forests are extremely valuable marine habitats that harbor small salmon and just a number of other marine resources, fish and shellfish. And so it's been an incredible success story. And now they're talking about the Oregon introduction didn't take either. So they're talking now about trying to do the same for Oregon.
We can't talk about salmon and talk about the Olympic Peninsula without talking about the restoration of the Elwha and the taking down of the dams along the Elwha.
Correct,
so what
yeah.
difference has that made with the salmon fishery right in our backyard?
Well, with the Elwha, it's been a remarkable turnaround. That was a river that was primarily in Olympic National Park. It's pristine forest. It's the ideal salmon habitat anywhere in the Northwest. Some 70 miles of spawning gravel stream and tributaries were shut off by the two dams that were built on the Elwha. So legislation passed in 92. By about 2011, the dams started coming out. And just over the past 10 or so years, a remarkable number and variety of species are reclaiming the Elwha River as far up as the upper reaches. Steelhead have become the real heroes of the Elwha restoration. Chinook salmon are also doing very well. Coho salmon are coming in faster than was expected. Still not quite fast enough that the river can be opened for sport fishery. However, this past year, the returns were good enough for the Elwha tribe to have a limited fishery in the river. And that's something that Linda Mapes, one of my co-authors in this book, covered beautifully for the Seattle Times. And it was a huge event that after nearly a century of no fish, that tribal members were able to once again fish the river. That's been extremely hopeful. The Elwha has also provided a model for a major salmon restoration dam removal project. Several dams are removed on the Klamath River in southern Oregon, northern California. And that will take away our title of being the largest salmon restoration project in the U.S. when that takes place.
Well, it's great that we were the model for others to say, hey, we can do this too. Linda introduced the idea of the snorkel surveys.
Yeah.
What's a snorkel survey?
So a biologist that works for the park, Sam Brankman, very dedicated biologist, he realized that the data they were getting from the rivers for the salmon in the rivers were somewhat spotty. He wanted to be able to do a complete survey of an entire river system and list every fish, every kind of fish, and where it is in the river. And he organized this for the Elwha and for a few other rivers on the peninsula where they pack in with mules and supplies, gear up in wetsuits and snorkels and masks and little cards that they could write on attached to their arms. And they swim sections of the river from the headwaters all the way down, gather the data, and then process all that. And it is an extreme picture of the Elwha. They did that early in the restoration. It's become state-of-the-art way of surveying what's happening.
Get underneath the water and see what's there behind that
rock.
See who's
hiding under the banks beneath the log jams. And it just sounds remarkable.
It does. And there are some wonderful photographs as well in this book of different aspects of the water above, the water below, and enjoyed the incredible photographs in this book. We're making good progress, and things are moving ahead, but what is the way ahead? You know, at the end of the book, I want you to do a little bit more of the reading about that, and specifically Tom Jay's.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Well, Tom was an old and dear friend of mine. So this is the epilogue of the book, and it goes into several of the restoration projects that are happening around the peninsula. I picked several, but I framed it with this idea of Tom Jay's, that restoring a natural system is restoring the landscape.
Restorying, making up a
new story.
Tell a good story.
So this is from the epilogue of the book. I'll read just a short section of it. Tom Jay was a sculptor, poet, and essayist on the Olympic Peninsula. He was a devotee of rivers and streams and a passionate defender of wild salmon. Tom was also a friend, and I had the good luck to work with him on several conservation efforts over the years. We documented wildlife use on the Duckabush River and fought hydroelectric dams on the Duckabush and Dozy Wallops. When the last chum salmon were at risk in Tom's home watershed of Chimicum Creek, Tom dove into restoration work. With his wife Sarah Jahani, he founded Wild Olympic Salmon to celebrate wild fish and revive stream habitat. In Reaching Home, Pacific Salmon, Pacific People, Tom wrote that restoration becomes restoring the landscape, telling a new story of humans' relationship with the places where we live. The past few decades have seen a blossoming of new stories across the peninsula landscape. Some are large watershed-scale restorations like the Elwha, others smaller community-based endeavors. All are working to restitch the ecological fabric of the peninsula, repair and reconnect habitats, and help creatures and natural process become more resilient in the face of climate change. And all tell a renewed story of people, tribes, and communities working in consort with the natural world. I'm going to just jump ahead to a very short little section at the close after listing quite a few of the restoration efforts, Tarboo Creek being one of them. I count myself lucky that my time on the peninsula has coincided with this gradual shift toward ecological recovery. From my first glimpse of a sea otter, restored on the coast in 1970, to witnessing the reintroduction of the first fishers to the snowy Elwha Valley 35 years later, I've seen vital pieces of the Olympic puzzle fit back into place. Each species restoration and each removal of a non-native and invasive species strengthens the resilience of the Olympic ecosystem and shores up hope for the future. So much has been saved and conserved on the peninsula. It gives us all hope that the work that remains can be accomplished. To me, the deeper importance of the Olympic Peninsula extends beyond the beauty and biological richness of this island-like ecosystem. It lies in the promise these lands and waters offer to the Northwest region, to the North Pacific Rim, and to the world. The peninsula was once a place where human society got it right. It could again. Imagine a place where humans can rediscover old and new ways to live sustainably with the larger community of life and share those relationships with a world hungry for a new story.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And thank you so much for coming in today,
Tim. Oh, well, thank you so much, Chris.
Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. I'd like to thank very much our engineer and editor today, Nora Petridge, and all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible.